The second case on today's oral argument calendar is case number A23-1356, Asma Javed versus Rizwan Sawani. Counsel, I know, are both familiar with our standard procedures. Please identify both yourself and your client as you begin your argument. And as a reminder, there's a button on the front ledge of the lectern, buttons to move the lectern up or down. Looks like you found it. You may begin when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Gary Diebele, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Dr. Rizwan Sawani. Also with me is my co-counsel, Sydney Peterson. May it please the court, counsel. We are here today to review a relocation decision issued by the district court in Olmsted County in a post-decree marriage dissolution proceeding. Two children, ages 8 and 11, these parties were married approximately 10 years prior to their divorce. And in May of last year, the respondent mother brought a motion to relocate herself and the children to Naperville, Illinois, from Rochester, Minnesota. Dr. Sawani objected to that. There was extensive briefing on the issue, arguments before the court, and the court issued a decision. And there were there was a request for reconsideration after that, and then there was also a motion asking the court to stay that decision and a request for an evidentiary hearing, all of which was denied. Our argument today, Your Honors, is really kind of broken into two kind of broad categories. The first section that I want to talk about are what I would consider the legal and procedural errors that we believe the trial court committed, and these come under the de novo standard of review, where this court does not owe any deference to the trial court on those issues. The second set of issues have to do with an abuse of discretion standard. One is how the court handled the request for reconsideration, and then secondly, just whether the relocation is supported by the findings of fact and the analysis that the court provided. It is our position that this relocation never should have been allowed, and we're asking the court to issue a decision that indicates the children should be returned to Minnesota, and if necessary, have further proceedings to determine what would be appropriate modifications to the parenting time schedule. And I think it probably is worth emphasizing a little bit in terms of what this divorce decree did when these parties were divorced with these two children. The parties were granted joint legal and joint physical custody of their two children. And the parenting time schedule that the appellant received as a result of that divorce decree was every other weekend from Friday until Monday morning, and then every Tuesday and Thursday from 5 to 7. And the resulting change to that parenting time arrangement after the relocation, we would submit, was a very substantial reduction. And in fact, moving into the legal arguments about the procedural and legal problems, there really are kind of three problems that we see with the resulting changes to the parenting schedule. Basically, there's a problem with this being what we call a substantial restriction, which, as the court, I'm sure, is aware, there's a lot of case law addressing what is a substantial restriction. And if you have a substantial restriction to somebody's parenting time, there are certain other rules and concepts that come into play, one of which is, are you required to have an evidentiary hearing before you make that substantial restriction? And then there's also a statute that creates a rebuttable presumption under our law that no parent should receive less than 25% of the parenting time. Now, I'm sure you noticed in the brief, we got rather bogged down in trying to figure out, how do we count parenting time? How do we determine what parenting time is for one of these situations? There are several different methods scattered throughout our family law code and subsequent case law, or case law interpreting the statutes. One methodology is you simply count overnights. How many overnights does the person get? That's the standard determination of what is parentage under a child support situation. Child support's very clear. We figure out how many overnights, plug that into the calculator, and then figure out. But there are other exceptions stated throughout the law when we don't just look at overnights. And our position on this, the appellant's position in this brief, is really when we're talking about quality of parenting time and how it's being impacted by a relocation decision like this, We prefer to use the concept of instances of, or incidents of parenting time. And that's how we calculated it when we looked at, because you have to determine a baseline on one of these things when you're looking at restrictions of parenting. And the baseline in this case goes back to the original divorce decree. It was not modified after that, up until this relocation came into play. And when we calculate the parenting time under that decree, we come up with about 180 incidents of parenting time over the year. And we don't even include holidays and visitation.
Are you including the evening time?
Yes, we are.
And how does that fit within the language of 518.175 subdivision 1G that talks about that you can use a method other than overnights if the parent has significant time periods on separate days and the child is in the parent's physical custody but does not stay overnight? So how does that, how are those evening times significant time periods within the meaning of that?
And this, I think, goes to the crux of my client's, what he felt so deprived of as a result of this. You know, 2 hours on two nights a week, that may not seem like a lot to a parent, but when kids are of this age, you know, they're in school most of the time, they've got activities after school, they go to bed during the week to get ready for school, having those 2 hours is a pretty significant time in the parenting process. It's a time for the parent and the children to have dinner together. It's a time to catch up on what went on in school that day. It's a time to talk about activities. It may be time that you're driving the kids back and forth to activities. So I think given Judge Cochran, the fact that they give the court some leeway in how you analyze it, I think that was our thinking on this, is those 2 days each week are critical, and those are not going to be able to happen when the mother moves with the children, you know, 6 hours away to Illinois. And
that
I know
that would occur in any case then where a parent moves, and we let parents move.
Sure. And I think, Your Honor, it's interesting. When we were looking into the case law on this, that was one of the questions we sort of grappled with, is does relocation create sort of a unique situation where this idea of restrictions on parenting time should somehow be treated differently? And my sense is there might be a little bit of a split between some of the cases, but we found at least 4 of them, and these are all cited in our brief. There's Clark versus Clark, Hagen versus Schirmers, Bertrand versus Krantz, and Anderson versus Archer, where the courts have basically said that, yes, there's going to be some reduction most likely with a relocation. But what those cases seem to suggest is if the court is going to allow the relocation, you really have to make every effort you can to sort of maintain the same quantity of parenting time, maybe a different quality. But at least, you know, there's an obligation that the restriction notion does not just go away because you're in a relocation case. A couple of the cases said, I think, exactly what you were alluding to, Judge Kirk, that, well, relocation is relocation, and of course there's going to be a reduction of parenting time. But I don't think it's that simple. And it's, in some cases, some sense, it's sort of fact-specific to your case. You know, is a restriction appropriate because of the way, you know, where they're moving and what the reason for the move is? You have to kind of look at it from all different angles. We would submit on this case, though, that they're really, what really you come back to, and this is just getting into my second category of arguments to some extent, but the sole basis that the trial court judge really landed on for justifying this relocation was the mother's request for more cultural diversity and more educational opportunities. There's a lot of stuff in the briefing that went on, and the court even makes some findings that, you know, there was some domestic abuse early on in the relationship. The judge said, that's not a part of my decision. She's not alleging domestic abuse is the reason for this. There's some discussion about my client has had some issues over the years with chemical dependency and mental health. All of those issues were dealt with by 2021, and the court made a finding. I'm not having any concern with any of those issues. And interestingly enough, this case is unusual. I rarely see a relocation case when the primary motivation for the relocation is not employment. It's almost always somebody going to get a different job, sometimes a new marriage, you know, the other spouse is moving somewhere. And this is sort of the elephant in the room in some respects on this case. One of the issues that my client brought up, there's not a lot of discussion when the motion is first brought about what the respondent's employment plans were. She's a physician at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. My client was previously employed at the Olmsted Medical Group and then lost that job and now has other employment. But What came out in the course of this, and this was one of the things that my client actually obtained more concrete information in and submitted it in his request for reconsideration, is that the respondent is still employed at the Mayo Clinic. She's going to be coming back to Rochester 1 week a month. And this was raised several times, and never did the respondent dispute that. In fact, she kind of ignores it, interestingly enough. There's no discussion in there, but she's going to be in Rochester. She has to, as part of her employment, doing clinical work, be in Rochester once a month. You know, and so the question is, this whole thing then rests on, and what the court really emphasized was the cultural diversity. He's saying, I don't think, you know, she was saying Rochester is not culturally diverse enough, which, you know, we could take judicial notice. Rochester is a very culturally diverse town. It's the Mayo Clinic's been there forever. They bring people in from all over the country. And
I think, you know, the district court was interested in South Asians or people of Pakistani descent, right?
I think so. There was some discussion, but not a lot. But, you know, if you look at the moving papers by the respondent, there is not a lot of detail about specifically what she's concerned about. And more importantly, there are no specifics about how she's going to address those issues when she moves to Naperville.
Wasn't there evidence that, I mean, she had remarried and that she had two new children with her second husband?
Right.
And he had a job in Naperville, I think, correct?
I don't know about that. He had like a computer job, and I think he was doing remote work. His family was from Naperville.
And there were relatives.
He had family there. Okay. Her family, and this was the other thing, that there weren't a lot of, like, the family was largely in Rochester. I mean, her.
Don't all of these reasons cut against your argument about restriction? Because, I mean, the reason for the reduction in parenting time could justify the characterization of restriction, but these reasons do not indicate that, do they?
Well, I didn't find the reason with the family connection to where she was moving as to be terribly compelling, because again, her mother lived with them in Rochester. Her husband and the two children were there in Rochester. My client was in Rochester.
I'm focusing now on the issue of restriction. You may be focusing on the balancing test and so on.
Oh, okay.
But I guess I'm on the issue of the reason for a reduction in parenting time. My understanding is that it could justify the determination that it's an improper restriction if the motive is to reduce, you know, to shift the parenting time or to harm the other parent's relationship with the children. But I don't see any evidence of that, any whiff of that.
Well, it harms the relationship with my client. That's the restriction that I think we're focusing on, is he's losing time with his children.
I think you're talking about the consequence, I thought that the motives were important, or at least.
Well, I think the motives are important. I mean, they say if your motive is to eliminate the other parent's parenting time, that's
right.
Obviously improper.
Right. Is there
any
of that?
I don't think anyone's alleging that's the issue here.
That's my point.
Oh,
okay. Thank
no,
you.
I don't think that's.
Can I go back to the issue of counting? Because, in Sulesky v. Rupe, we used overnights.
Right.
Does that foreclose your way of counting?
No, I don't think so, because I think you have to look back on what was the original order, how was the parenting time set up, and if it was a typical order where you get X number of overnights each week, then maybe you would keep doing that. But the fact that in this particular case, we've got overnights on those alternating weekends, but then we've got these blocks of 2 hours twice a week, and I think it's important to recognize that those are significant contacts.
So if we count those contacts in that way for your client, don't we then have to count in a similar way for respondent, and then we add, so it adds up to more than 365 then, right? I mean, if there's multiple days, many days, where they both have that type of contact, then.
Well, I think each child would get a day counted in their favor based on if they have contact with the child that day.
But on Tuesdays and Thursdays, then both parents have contact.
Well,
both count. So then we have 180. But then we have to expand the denominator.
Then you have 450 days of the year. So I mean, then I don't think we need to get lost in the weeds so much on that, because I really do think if you kind of think of the importance of what is the relationship like and what are we trying to protect in these cases, it's to maintain a relationship. The judge's view was pretty clear. He thought, look, I'm giving you 8 weeks in the summer, Christmas break or winter break and spring break, and furthermore, you have all this opportunity to fly down to Illinois or drive down to Illinois every weekend because the mother is obligated to make time for you. Well, first of all, these two didn't have a great relationship, and I think there's some question whether that was going to work. He just says, I'm coming down this weekend. Is she going to agree? I don't know. So our view was that was not a really good solution. But more to the point, the court's whole premise on this, and this gets into this reconsideration, which I want to talk a little bit about because it's a significant issue. If you read the judge's decision, both the original order and then after these post-trial motions were brought, he basically says, because you don't have a fixed job at this point and your immigration status is in flux, you can go and you can move to Illinois and get a job, but you can go down anytime you want. What he learned subsequent to that, and the court was aware this could happen, it was discussed, he got a job at the Wayzata Children's Clinic, which has flexibility. He can still live in Rochester, which he intended to do and told the court that. But then his immigration matter got resolved. He's got permanent residency, so that's no longer an issue. He brought this up in the request for reconsideration, and the judge just issued a check off the box order, said denied, no explanation. It was raised again in the motions for the stay and the evidentiary hearing, and again, no discussion whatsoever. The judge held fast to his view that you've got infinite flexibility and you can go down there anytime you want, which really wasn't true. And then he also raised in that motion, and by the way, the respondent is going to be up here once a week, every month. And none of these factors came in. The judge said, nope, I'm not going to look at that. I'm not going to consider that. I'm holding fast to my order here, which is this is what you get. And that as a result, my client went from 180-some contacts a year down to 80, which is pretty dramatic in my view, in his view. And there was no opportunity to further question the basis of this relocation. There was
so, Mr. Deeply, I'm not sure if you're aware, but your time has expired about a minute ago. But
I will sit down.
Okay, thank you. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, please introduce yourself and your clients, and then you may begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Stephen Groshen. I represent the respondent, Asma Javed. One thing I want to start with is to focus on the overarching theme of this case, because there are a lot of technical arguments, and I will address them. But this case isn't about restricting appellant's parenting time. It was about relocating two kids to Naperville, Illinois to improve their lives. That was the reason for the move, and that's what the district court focused on. In this case, I think we have somewhat unique circumstances in that we have not one but two memorandums, one 9 pages, another one 10 pages, single-spaced, with the district court very meticulously going through the best interest factors, going through appellant's arguments, and then weighing all of those against what's in the best interest of the kid. The other major theme I want to hit that I see throughout appellant's arguments are the district court found he had the ability to do this. Not necessarily that he would. If he chooses to get a job in Minnesota or a job in the Twin Cities, that was his choice. That doesn't take away from the district court's finding that he could have found a job in Naperville or Chicago or someplace that would be more convenient to travel down there. I see this as sort of two major arguments. Appellant's arguments are in category one as to getting to an evidentiary hearing. And as the court noted when it asked appellant's counsel questions, this really comes down to whether there was a restriction. The case law essentially, they say whether it was a substantial reduction. I'm sort of reading this in my own language. They're looking at whether it was reasonable. And Judge Johnson, I think your question goes to this. It looks like when the Court of Appeals is previously analyzing these cases, they are sort of intertwining the reasons for the move associated with the practicalities of the move. So the reason why the move took place was in part to improve the education of the children. And so when analyzing whether there's a restriction, this court needs to consider, okay, they move there to improve their education. Is this going to cause some sort of reduction in parenting time? And as I said, that sort of blends a little bit to the motive as it relates to that. The other thing I think appellant and I agree on is that it's not just a number. We're not just looking at the number. We're also considering the motive when we're determining whether something's a restriction. As I noted in my brief, there's many, many different ways we can calculate the number of overnights, but my position is we should use overnights. The primary reason is it wasn't argued in district court to use a different form of calculating the days, and we would have presented different evidence. We could have added different things into the affidavit or other information about those Tuesdays or Thursdays. What's kind of unfortunate is I do agree that the case law says we need to look at the prior order, even though the parties weren't actually following that. And I'll note this for a moment, that my client had actually given another overnight informally to appellant, even though there wasn't a court order. Again, when we're discussing the motive for the move and we're discussing whether my client will cooperate with giving appellant additional parenting time in the future, that is directly relevant. As far as the number, though, I will comment on the 182 days. That just doesn't make sense. That's essentially an equal parenting time schedule, and appellant had a motion pending to request an equal parenting time schedule in district court. So those two things I see as just directly contradictory. I also just want to emphasize again, when we're calculating the time, that the court used the language shall, that my client shall cooperate or coordinate with appellant in order to get parenting time on those weekends. The other thing that isn't necessarily discussed in the order but isn't foreclosed in any way is that the appellant could coordinate time for the children to come to Minnesota as well. There's nothing in the order that precludes that from happening. I will note in appellant's reply brief, they made a comment about vacation days. I read the district court order as only modifying anything in conflict with the current decree. So it didn't replace the entire decree when they issued that order, and the decree had vacation days in it. Those didn't just disappear because there was a modification of parenting time related to the relocation. And practically speaking, how they would be exercised is a lot of those holidays are attached to Mondays or days off of school, and so appellant could coordinate time on those days, have a 3-4 day weekend during those holidays when he has when it's his year for those. So those should certainly be counted as when we're looking at whether there was this restriction.
Agree that the district court didn't address the rebuttable presumption in the statute?
The 25%?
Yes, in its findings.
I agree.
And can you address appellant's argument that they, that in their reply brief, that that basically they preserved that issue when they argued that the court's order amounted to a substantial change in one of their filings, subsequent filings?
Yeah, so I believe what appellant said was implicitly, which means there's no citation in the record to it. I looked through the transcripts from the hearing. I looked back through the briefs. After I read the reply brief, I didn't see any reference to that specific statute, which under, let me just jump ahead to note the case. Under Hagen v. Shimmers, which is what I cited in my responsive brief, the Court of Appeals had noted that had been brought up before district court, there wasn't an argument about the 25% presumption. And again, given how detailed the district court's opinion was, if it was brought up, the district court would have addressed it. Secondly, I also think it wouldn't have mattered since the district court calculated the number of days above 25%. And as I presented in my my math, there are many ways in which we can calculate the days where the total number of days appellant would have would be above 25%. And Your Honor,
when
I noted-
you say the district court calculated the days above 25%, what are you referring to?
I believe the district court stated 130 overnights approximately with appellant exercising the weekends.
Okay.
And so through the district court's math, it would be above the 25% presumption.
But the order doesn't guarantee the weekends.
Depends on how we look at the word guarantee. So I see It does, since they shall cooperate, and I believe appellant could bring a motion for...
It says shall work together to facilitate additional parenting time, but that's kind of vague. How does that guarantee specific weekend time? I guess that's what I'm trying to get at.
Sure. I don't think I'm going to be able to use the word guarantee. I understand if that's the
why should the weekend time be counted then if it's not mandatory?
Sure. It should be counted because respondent is forced to cooperate to do it. It shall. She could be held in contempt if she's not trying to coordinate it. So let me just give you a hypothetical. Let's say every weekend that appellant asks to come down, keeps making the request, gives plenty of notice ahead of time, and respondent says, no, this weekend doesn't work, no, this weekend doesn't work, doesn't present any good reasoning for that, and doesn't come up with an alternative weekend in which appellant could come down.
Well, what if she does come up with a reason? They have this activity planned or that activity planned, and and it turns out father doesn't get any weekends for 3 months because of all their other plans.
I believe the appellant could bring a motion for contempt under those circumstances, and the district court would analyze it and determine whether there was a good reason for it, but it's hard for me to imagine a scenario where all of those weekends would be denied, or even a substantial amount of those weekends. And so, again, that's why I'm using the range and why the district court was also analyzing a range of weekends. So not counting any of the weekends obviously would lower the number, but I don't think that's realistic given the history here. The district court also had the history, as I noted earlier in my argument, that respondent had been giving appellant an additional overnight without being court ordered to do it. There's also ample evidence in the affidavits in the court record for the district court to find that respondent is cooperative and will coordinate that time. Returning to the, well, I guess this also directly relates to your question, Judge Cochran. The other sort of avenue that's available too, again, this doesn't convert it to guaranteed, is if this plan is unworkable in some form, then the parties were ordered to consult with a parenting time consultant. And it's very clear what the district court's trying to do here. Made a decision about what's in the best interest of the children and trying to formulate a plan as best as the district court can to not restrict or decrease appellant's parenting time.
Mr. Groshans, can I, more question about
counting
and overnights. Subdivision 5A of 0.175 says that, talks about using overnights or overnight equivalents. Do you think that applies to either the restriction analysis generally or the restriction analysis if it arises from a relocation?
I think it does if you argue it. So sort of the odd situation we have here is I agree it's a de novo standard of review looking at the definition of a restriction on whether something's a restriction, but this court still has to analyze everything in the record. And when that argument is not made in district court, then there's evidence absent from the record that could have been there that would help the district court or this court address whether something other than an overnight should be used.
Okay, thank you.
I'll touch briefly on the motion for reconsideration. I'll just note that the appellant had found a job in the Twin Cities, and again, one of the primary findings of the district court's order was that he had the ability to find work in different places and had a flexible travel schedule in which he could exercise his parenting time. On the best interest factors, I think my brief mostly points that out to the court, but I'll just note there are a lot of citations that took a lot of time. What I was trying to show was there's ample evidence in the record, and to the extent that appellant disagrees, those are credibility determinations. The district court had a lot of evidence to find that this case is unique. We have two doctors. We have two doctors of ample resources and ample ability for flexibility in crafting a parenting time plan, and the district court did so in order to do what's in the best interest of these children, and that's what happened here. If there are no...
Counsel, go ahead, Judge. You know, when we're looking at visitation, we're usually looking at the parent's ability to have the children in his or her own home, not to, you know, go miles away and spend a weekend in a hotel or something with the kids or trek them back and forth, which I think is a terrible thing to do to kids. But so subjectively, how is this a good thing for these kids?
Sure. So the travel, obviously, that is not something that cuts in favor for the children. I will acknowledge that. But the primary thing the court was looking at was finding a better community for the children. And being close to the father is in the best interest of the children. That's one of the factors. Of course, I agree with that.
Wrong with Rochester as a community?
What's wrong with Rochester is listed pretty extensively in the order. It relates to how especially the older minor child was doing in school, the experiences she had had in school, the insufficiency of another local school district that wasn't a good alternative. The respondent's husband also had family in the, I'll call it the Naperville, Chicago area. The grandmother was willing to come, so now the children are going to spend more time with cousins and other family members down there. And then there's also just a lot more diversity specific to the two minor children here. And so, as the district court said, it wasn't a close case in that aspect of what's in the best interest of the children. There's never going to be a perfect order where there isn't some sort of negative ramifications of a move. It's a move. There's going to be some sort of change in parenting time, and it's going to be a little bit more difficult. But I'll end with what's unique about this case is appellant can move. Appellant has the resources. Appellant has the education. Appellant has the ability to move closer. And so if there's a better school district, a better area for the children, he can move down there and avoid a lot of these sort of issues that come from the distance. I respectfully request that this court affirm the district court order. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Groshans. Mr. Deebly, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to just focus in my 5 minutes kind of on the question that you asked, Judge Kirk, what's wrong with Rochester, and go to a bigger question. Was this move even necessary? I mean, the respondent is going to continue to work at the Mayo Clinic and be here once a week. If you look closely at the record, there's precious little in her initial pleadings that support this cultural and educational idea. We don't know where the kids are going to go to school when she brings her motion. She had not done any information on the school district, what the programs were. The two critiques that she based this on and why she wanted to move was culturally, she said there wasn't enough religious involvement. And then secondly, the educational issue, because there wasn't a fencing extracurricular available to the daughter. But other than that, we have very little detail about what homework she had done in terms of what was available in terms of culture, what was available in education. And that's what this whole case is premised on. Not about a job move that she has to be down there. Even the family connections are slim in my view. The brother, her brother, is an hour away. And the family that's in this community, as far as we can tell from the record, is her husband's family. Not her family, her husband's family. And, you know, one of the leading cases on relocation where the Minnesota Supreme Court struggled with this very issue is Goldman versus Greenwood, a very fractured decision by the Minnesota Supreme Court. We ended our main brief with a reference to that. You know, that couple fought for years, and they had a locale restriction in their original divorce decree, so that sort of complicated the issue. But if you read that case closely, the bottom line was the reason the mother wanted to move, she was Orthodox Jewish. There were not Orthodox schools in Minnesota, and she wanted better education for the children. And the Supreme Court said education and culture versus a relationship with a parent, which is more important? The Supreme Court pretty clearly, the majority said that relationship with the parent should trump that unless there's a really good reason for this relocation. And I would submit we don't have that here. This idea that my client was flexible and could move and go anywhere, the evidence doesn't support that. And this judge was not interested in getting the most current information when that request for reconsideration came in. He premised his whole case on the idea that this guy's got immigration problems, he doesn't have a job right now, and he's looking. There was all sorts of mention about him looking for a job. He found a job, and it's in Wayzata, and he can keep his house in Rochester. He can do remote work. It would work for him. The judge didn't even mention it anywhere, ignored it. And this idea that the mother still comes to Rochester 1 week a month. Why are we doing this? That's our position, Your Honor. Whether you talk about it, whether it's a restriction or not, counting days and overnights and what does that mean, let's just look at the fundamental issue here. What's the basis for this move? What's the impact on this father and the relationship with his children? And is this necessary? I don't think it was. I don't know what the judge's motives were on this, why he did what he did, but it just doesn't make any sense for a relocation case.
So let me, to comment on that, I do think there seems to be not a lot of discussion about her remarriage and the rootedness of her new husband and so on. But maybe it's just, I'm wondering if it's because that issue was just sort of not in dispute. But I mean, in many relocation cases, that's maybe the only reason or the primary reason, and that's, depending on the circumstances, that can be enough.
Right.
But in this case, I'm wondering if there was that was the first reason, the most solid reason, and then these cultural and educational reasons were additional reasons.
Well, I was not the trial attorney in this, so I don't, but I read the record, just like we've all read the record, and my impression from that record is that her husband, I think he was doing some education during the marriage. I think he was still getting some computer training or whatever his background was. He was doing that remotely, and my understanding was he either worked for the Mayo Clinic with a computer-type job or he had some remote job. I don't see anything in that record that says he had to relocate for employment purposes. In fact, I would assume she's probably the primary breadwinner, being a physician at the Mayo Clinic, and he's a computer person. So, this idea that somehow his need to move was the motivating factor, and even if it was, is that a proper basis to allow this move because her spouse that she marries afterwards, and they have two young children together, and he might have some family members down there, but her family members are, that's not, in my mind, that wasn't a compelling reason for them to go. Her family, her mother was living with them in Rochester.
Can you remind me, was her new husband also a Minnesotan and then relocated with her, or was he always based in Illinois, right?
I think he had ties to Naperville. I'm not sure if he was Pakistani or not. I know both of the parties in this case were Pakistani. I'm assuming he was from somewhere in South Asia as well. I don't know his culture and racial background, but my understanding was that he was the one that had the tie to Naperville, and it just happened to be.
Well, I guess my question is, when they got married, where was the new husband living? In Minnesota, or was he?
I'm under the impression she may have met him in Minnesota, and I don't know. I don't know that for a fact, Your Honor, and I'm not even sure that was in the record. But again, I come back to the idea of how critical of a question, a factor is that when you're looking at a relocation, when you've got the two parents with, are both doctors, and have both been tied in Rochester for basically the bulk of their careers, and they've got these two kids who are involved in activities, and the father's involved. The court makes findings that my client has a very close and involved relationship with the kids, which would be a finding that would go against relocation. But he doesn't pick up on that. He focuses instead on this culture, the cultural issue, and the religious issue, and the education. And, I don't know how the school compares in Naperville with Rochester. I mean, my impression has always been Rochester is one of the top public schools in the state. You've got all these Mayo Clinic physicians and people affiliated with Mayo. They want intense, schools that are going to support academics and activities and stuff. And so if you're building this on a school issue and a religious upbringing, well, where was she? She didn't even say what she was going to do for religious training for the kids. But in Rochester, it wasn't good enough. So move. So, Your Honor, we think there's no basis factually for this move. Legally, we think the court didn't follow the proper procedures, and we would ask that the relocation decision be reversed and the children returned to Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dibley. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.